Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the March 28th, 2025 issue of the Week. The cover drawing this week, it looks like we're set in some hilly backcountry at kind of a crossroads or cross paths. We have a strange scene. There's a donkey, but it's got two heads pointed in opposite directions. And seated atop the donkey are Senator Chuck Schumer and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. They're facing different directions. The way Schumer's facing on the sign, it says fight another day. The other direction is resist at all costs. And they're looking at each other with quite a concerned look on their faces. Anyway, the headline is Which Way? The Democratic Divide Over How to Stop Trump. And we picked that up as a Talking Points article. We'll start, as usual, with one of the main stories. Putin rejects full ceasefire with Ukraine. What happened? Russian President Vladimir Putin this week nixed President Trump's 30-day ceasefire plan, which Ukraine had accepted, and insisted that peace would require the U.S. and Europe to halt all military and intelligence aid to Ukraine. In a two-hour phone call, the two leaders settled on a lesser ceasefire, a 30-day pause on attacks on power plants and refineries, plus a prisoner swap. The White House readout of the call said the agreement barred strikes on energy and infrastructure. And Trump later told Fox News, we didn't talk about aid at all. But the Kremlin's readout maintained that only attacks on energy infrastructure would be paused, and that Putin had insisted the key condition to peace was a total halt to foreign military and intelligence aid to Kyiv. In any case, a few hours after the phone call, Russia broke the agreement with drone strikes on a Ukrainian power plant and a hospital. Steve Witkoff, one of Trump's senior advisors, said the drones had left before Putin relayed the ceasefire order, adding he felt the Russian leader had acted in good faith. Trump also spoke with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky this week and proposed the U.S. take ownership of the Ukrainian energy facilities and nuclear plants, saying that would ensure those sites were protected. Over the past few weeks, while Ukraine was contending with a pause in U.S. aid and intelligence, Russia retook almost all of Ukrainian-held Kursk, Russian territory Kyiv was hoping to trade for Russian-occupied regions of Ukraine. Ukraine suffered a further blow this week when the U.S. canceled funding for a program that documented alleged Russian war crimes, including the abductions of Ukrainian children. What the columnist said. Putin has played Trump, said Tom Rogan in the Washington Examiner. First, he kept the president waiting for an hour, laughing with Russian businessmen about his power move before deigning to get on the phone. When he finally picked up, he promised only the absolute minimum, a pledge not to hit power plants, and then broke that agreement almost immediately. The very same Trump who bullied Ukraine into painful concessions simply accepted Putin's refusal of a full ceasefire without complaint. Trump did at least get Ukraine a bit of a breather, said Jonathan Lemire in The Atlantic. Russia has been relentless in bombarding Ukraine's energy grid, and if those strikes actually stop, it would be the most significant mutually agreed upon suspension of attacks in 3 years of war. Still, the pause is also in Putin's interest. Ukraine has recently been doing damage to Russia's gas and oil facilities, and Russia, hobbled by Western sanctions, desperately needs oil income to fund its military. If only Trump could see the Russian despot for the aggressor he is, and not just toward Ukraine, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. Russia has been a force for instability all over the Middle East. It supported the former Assad regime's massacres of civilians in Syria. To this day, Moscow provides aircraft for Iran and gives Yemen's Houthis the intelligence that allows them to target U.S. ships. Most Americans see this clearly. Three-quarters of them, including 69% of Republicans, don't trust Putin to honor a ceasefire. Frankly, neither Putin nor Trump can be trusted, said Kathy Young in the Bulwark. The two sides didn't even agree on what they said. Was something lost in translation? Did Trump have a senior moment? Did the Kremlin lie? All three scenarios are plausible. The only conclusion we can draw is that Putin doesn't want an end to the conflict and is simply dressing up his no as a yes, but, and that Trump won't do a thing to pressure him. Just how far the U.S. is willing to go in appeasing Putin is chillingly unclear, said Mark Champion in Bloomberg. Putin has broken dozens of previous agreements, and giving in to his current ultimatums would sound the death knell for Ukraine's existence as a state. Trump has already conceded key Kremlin demands, such as keeping Ukraine out of NATO, and Semaphore reports that he is considering recognizing illegally annexed Crimea as Russian territory. If we assume that he knows the first thing about negotiations, Trump's goal for these talks can't be a lasting peace for Ukraine or stability in Europe. Is the Art of the Deal author a bad negotiator, or does he have some other end goal? Controversy of the week, Columbia University. Is Trump at war with free speech? This really could be the end of the university as we know it, said Megan O'Rourke in the New York Times. After canceling $400 million in federal funding for Columbia University, the Trump administration last week ordered that the school make a series of drastic changes, including placing its Middle Eastern, South Asian, and African studies departments under academic receivership to get the money back. Ostensibly, this is intended to rectify Columbia's continued inaction against anti-Semitism, but that rationale is highly questionable. Last year's campus protest over Israel's war in Gaza led to the resignation of Columbia's then president, the expulsion of several students, and the creation of an anti-Semitism task force at the school. More to the point, it's hard to see how cutting funds for research into breast cancer and pediatric health will make Columbia's Jewish students more comfortable, but easy to see how that will advance conservatives' ambition to rein in universities they consider elitist indoctrination centers. A day after the cuts were announced, federal agents arrested former Columbia grad student Mahmoud Khalil, said Irie Center in Politico. A green card holder with an 8 months pregnant American wife, the Palestinian activist had helped lead the Gaza protest. Now he is languishing in a detention center awaiting deportation, all for daring to exercise his free speech rights by peacefully protesting. Like his alma maters, Khalil's fate is in the hands of right-wing ideologues who have declared war on higher education. Americans tolerate a lot of dissent, said Dan McLaughlin in National Review. But Khalil's behavior went beyond mere expression of opinion when he acted as a lead negotiator for pro-Hamas protesters who stormed Columbia buildings and engaged in targeted harassment of Jewish students. U.S. law allows for the deportation of visa and green card holders whose presence in the U.S. could have serious adverse foreign policy consequences. and Khalil and other pro-Palestinian agitators meet that definition perfectly. Because American universities and the safe environment they offer foreign students, including Israeli Jews, are a valuable tool of our public diplomacy. As for Columbia, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial, that lost $400 million is important discipline for an institution that too long chose to coddle anti-Semites rather than protect Jewish students. This has nothing to do with protecting Jews, said Jonathan Chait in The Atlantic. Trump presides over a political movement in which accidental Nazi salutes now happen with disturbing frequency, and grotesque anti-Semites like Andrew Tate and Candace Owens enjoy prominence and legitimacy. This supposed war against Jew hatred is simply a pretext for Trump's authoritarian crackdown on free speech. The attack on due process is just as serious, said David French in the New York Times. Just as the administration refused to let Khalil have a privileged conversation with his lawyer until it was ordered to do so by a judge, the White House also ignored Columbia's legal right to challenge its loss of funding in court. The university is patient zero in an outbreak of censorship and repression. And don't kid yourself that it will stop with Columbia. If Americans are going to resist, it has to happen now, said Adam Serwer in The Atlantic. Foreign-born activists and snooty academics don't make for sympathetic victims. And that's the point. Trump knows if we accept that free speech and due process are optional for this category of people or that one, he can then strip those rights from all of us. And we likely won't notice until it's too late. Here's our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for homecomings after a SpaceX capsule carrying NASA astronauts Sonny Williams and Butch Wilmore, whose International Space Station mission was extended from 8 days to 9 months because of technical problems with the Boeing spacecraft, splashed down in the waters off Florida and was quickly surrounded by a pod of curious dolphins. It's a good week for keepsakes. After White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt rejected a suggestion by French lawmaker Raphael Glucksmann that the U.S. mark its slide into autocracy by returning the Statue of Liberty to France. Absolutely not, said Leavitt. It's only because of the United States of America that the French are not speaking German right now. And it was a good week for Donald Trump, who for at least the second year in a row claimed to have won the annual golf championship at his club in Palm Beach, Florida. Such a great honor, Trump 78 wrote on social media. Such fun. But it was a bad week for husbands after Polish researchers concluded that getting married triples obesity rates among men, but has no equivalent effect on women. Catherine Jenner of Britain's Obesity Health Alliance said the disparity could reflect a male's predisposition to increased portion sizes, social eating, and a decline in physical activity after getting married. It was a bad week for Justin Eichhorn after the Minnesota state senator introduced a bill to recognize Trump derangement syndrome as a mental illness and just hours later was arrested for trying to solicit a 17-year-old girl for prostitution. Justin has a difficult road ahead, said state GOP Senate leadership. Finally, it was a bad week for scamps after a UK petition to ban slingshots passed the 10,000 signature mark, obligating the government to respond. Organizer Danny Rogers says the ban is needed because of attacks on humans and infrastructure and warned that the assailants may ramp up their targets. And a short and other news piece right here. Social Security cuts phone service for many beneficiaries. The Social Security Administration this week announced a change that could make it harder for many recipients to apply for benefits. From March 31st, people who want to file for benefits or change the bank where their payments will be deposited will no longer be able to do so by phone and must first verify their identity online or in person at a field office. The Trump administration said the policy change is needed to combat fraudulent activity. Advocates note that many older or disabled beneficiaries may struggle with online services or have difficulty in traveling to an office. Dozens of them are being shuttered. The new ID system could lead to as many as 85,000 extra in-person visitors a week to field offices, where the average current wait time for an appointment is longer than a month. Wait times could climb even higher if the agency pushes ahead with announced plans to cut 12% of its workforce. And on the briefing, we have Trump's TPS takedown. The president plans to deport 1 million immigrants with protected status. What effects will that have? Who has status? Temporary protected status is a program that protects from deportation immigrants whose home countries are unsafe because of war, disease, or environmental disaster. Congress created it in 1990 to cover a gap in the asylum system. At the time, the legal definition of refugee was extremely narrow, which meant that people fleeing the conflicts in Central America didn't qualify. Now, roughly 1.2 million immigrants from 16 countries, from Sudan to Afghanistan to Ukraine, are in the U.S. under TPS, the vast majority of them from the collapsing nations of Haiti and Venezuela. These people are allowed to work and pay taxes while they stay, and many are well established in their communities. Although protected status is only temporary, allotted for 6 to 18 months at a time, it can be continuously renewed if home country conditions warrant. The average TPS immigrant has resided in the U.S. for more than 20 years. How is TPS under threat? Upon taking office, Trump ordered that TPS be revoked for some 600,000 Venezuelans and 520,000 Haitians. Last month, Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem lifted TPS protections for the two groups. Some 350,000 Venezuelans now have 60 days to leave the country, while another 250,000 Venezuelans will lose their status in September. In the case of Venezuela, Trump said TPS no longer applied because Venezuela had agreed to take the migrants back. But since many of the Venezuelans who fled the authoritarian leftist regime have openly criticized strongman Nicolas Maduro, returning would be almost suicidal, says Venezuelan activist Beatriz Olivaria. They set foot in Venezuela and they will be jailed. Trump offered no reason, though, for kicking out the Haitians. Most of them first came to the U.S. when a massive earthquake devastated the island in 2010. Others fled the horrific gang violence of the past few years. They're set to lose their protective status in August. "My heart is breaking," said Sharika Blank, 34, who has lived in the U.S. for 15 years and has four American citizen children. She now faces deportation to a country controlled by brutal militants, where most people live on less than a dollar a day. Why is Trump opposed to TPS? The Republican Party has long argued that TPS has become a de facto permanent residency program for immigrants from poor countries. The program was intended to be a short-term fix for people facing an emergency, but the T for temporary is now being ignored, with most TPS recipients getting automatically renewed year after year. And that, conservative critics say, leaves these immigrants in legal limbo, without a pathway to citizenship, but also without any incentive to reintegrate into their home country. Republicans also say that Democratic presidents have used TPS, which is bestowed by the White House, as a way to get around immigration laws passed by Congress. President Joe Biden invoked the program to grant amnesty by executive fiat to millions of illegal aliens, the American First Policy Institute said in 2023. Is there any pushback? The administration is battling multiple lawsuits brought by immigrant advocacy groups, the ACLU and others, that seek to block the revocation of TPS. The order is plainly illegal, said UCLA law professor Ahilan Arulanantham. Terminations can only occur at the end of an extension. An exception could be made if the government declared Haiti and Venezuela to be safe. But both countries are listed under the State Department's most severe designation, do not travel. There's reason to believe the lawsuits will succeed. In his first term, Trump tried to end TPS designations for six countries, but was blocked by the courts. If the administration prevails, though, it could begin deporting more than a million people over the next year. What happens then? The U.S. economy might take a hit. TPS households hold $8 billion in purchasing power and pay more than $1 billion in federal taxes a year, as well as nearly $1 billion more in state and local taxes. And TPS holders have a high labor participation rate. Haitians' labor force participation rate is 88%, and Venezuelans is 75%, well above the total U.S. population's rate of 63%. The prospect that they might be deported is terrifying for communities that rely on their labor. In Doral, Florida, known as Doralzuela, a third of the population is Venezuelan. Springfield, Ohio, was dying before some 15,000 Haitians arrived to revive it. And in recent years, the city's revenue has exploded. People are making money from renting to them, providing services, employing them, said Springfield City Council member Carla Thompson. All of that is going to go away. What about the immigrants? Should you get deported, you are kind of left for dead, said Harry Jean-Baptiste, a Haitian living in Houston. Haiti is a desperately poor country overrun by bloodthirsty gangs that murdered nearly 6,000 people last year and displaced a million more. In Venezuela, a country from which 7.5 million people have fled since Maduro took power in 2013 and collapsed the economy, most people still rely on humanitarian assistance for food. Both countries would deteriorate further if their migrants came home, since both of their economies rely heavily on remittances from U.S.-based expats. Adelis Ferro, head of a group representing Venezuelan Americans, said she feels beyond betrayed by Trump. We are not here because we came as tourists, she said. We are here because we got kicked out from our country. Time for some of the best columns of the week. The first one comes from the U.S. The U.S.'s reputation is ruined. Thanks to Donald Trump, America's whole reputation is shot, said David Brooks. Our nation spent a century cultivating strong alliances with other democracies, but Trump has smashed those relationships to smithereens. Over the past 2 months, the president has divorced America from the era of superpower peace by virtually ending our defense commitment to Europe, launching a culture war against Western liberalism, and slapping punishing tariffs on our European and North American allies. In shock and revulsion, they now see that America, the nation they thought was their friend, is actually a rogue superpower, a Judas whose leader is aligning with aligning the U.S. with Vladimir Putin's Russia. Our spurned allies no longer blame Trump alone, since Americans re-elected him and thus chose to abandon our ideals. Europeans are now reorganizing their defense programs, knowing that U.S. support for NATO is effectively over. China will inevitably exploit our isolationism. As America betrays its friends, China will seek to make them. At some point, Trumpian incompetence will provoke a counter-reaction, and Americans may again recognize that our alliances with other free nations are actually the source of America's long-term might. This is a How They See Us column from Europe, making Trump regret those wine tariffs. Hands off our bubbles, said Emmanuel Barretta. President Donald Trump has once again drawn his favorite weapon, massive tariffs, and threatened that if European Union doesn't rescind its 50% tariff on American whiskey, set to take effect next month, the United States will hit EU countries with a 200% tariff on wine and spirits. The entire world is ripping us off, Trump bellowed on social media. Never mind that European leaders only imposed their liquor tax to answer Trump's 25% tariff on steel and aluminum. Endless retaliation will hurt everyone, of course, but if Trump insists on playing this game, we have no choice but to match him move for move, to show that Europe will no longer let itself be trampled. We have options, for example, targeted customs duties or import-export restrictions, and if Trump hits our precious champagne, we can wallop back against American drinks, like Coca-Cola. Remember, Mr. President, shaking the bottle too much sometimes sends the cork flying into your face. Trump's trade war is a ticking time bomb, said Solvig Gordeluk and Richard Hout in Les Echos from France. It will truly explode on April 2nd when he imposes duties on specific imports, including microchips, lumber, cars, and pharmaceuticals, as well as reciprocal tariffs on thousands of other items. He's trying to force Europe to lower its value-added tax, which he considers a trade barrier, even though it's seldom been treated as such in world trade talks, and to lower its taxes on digital giants. If Trump does what he has threatened, he will set fire to an international system that has worked well for decades. It's idiocy, yet here we are again, fighting stupid with more stupid, said Jacob Hanvela from Germany. In Trump's first term, the then head of the EU, Jean-Claude Juncker, admitted that retaliatory tariffs to answer Trump's steel tariffs were a dumb idea, but concluded, "We can be that stupid. We have to be that stupid. Trump needs to learn that others can respond with brute force as well. He can't continue his economic bullying if everyone fights back." These Trumpian whims are already backfiring, said Le Echo from Belgium in an editorial. Prices are rising. Farmers are panicking. Businesses are worried. Even Tesla, which is run by Trump's sidekick Elon Musk, sent the administration a letter urging it to ease up. That's good advice for us, too. The worst trade barriers we face are the regulations and subsidies that differ from EU country to EU country. Eliminating these impediments to intra-European trade might be the only way for the time being to confront the madness in Washington. Time will do the rest, said Bart Eekhout from Belgium. In 1930, President Herbert Hoover signed high import tariffs to help U.S. farmers and wound up supercharging the Great Depression. Trump is flinging tariffs like he's throwing darts at a board, creating uncertainty, raising business costs, and tanking stocks. When this hits the bank accounts of his powerful sponsors, internal pressure will force him to back down. There will be no time for Schadenfreude then. Europe will have to pick up the pieces, with or without our former ally and protector. This column comes from Norway, making a fortune off Ukraine's war. Our European neighbors must think we're a nation of money grubbers and war profiteers, said Asbjørn Farstad. Norway has amassed a huge windfall from the Ukraine war that could solve the continent's defense problems instantly. Our sovereign wealth fund is now worth more than $1.8 trillion, and $118 billion of that came straight from our neighbors' pockets. Shortly after Russia invaded Ukraine, Vladimir Putin cut off Russian gas supplies to Europe, sending energy prices skyrocketing. That left Norway, the continent's biggest gas supplier, to lap up the profits. All the while, the same European allies we were gouging were pushing their budgets to the limit to help fund Ukraine's fight. Now the war has reached a critical turning point, with increasingly unfriendly signals from Washington as President Trump squeezes Kyiv and flirts with Moscow. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen's plan for an $800 billion plus fund to rearm EU countries and help replace disappearing U.S. aid is creating a massive new burden. We owe it to our allies to start plowing money into the effort. Yet until this month, when we belatedly more than doubled our Ukraine aid to $8 billion, we were actually giving the beleaguered country a smaller share of GDP than our Scandinavian neighbors. Thanks to our stinginess, people now see us as Europe's Uncle Scrooge. The Last Word, a feature article, A Promise of Shelter. Housing the homeless isn't just a question of finding space, said Susan Frankel in the San Francisco Standard. It requires earning the trust of people on society's margins. Kane moved into San Francisco's Golden Gate Park sometime in the late 1990s. He's vague on the date or details that led to him living outside, but he remembers exactly what he brought with him. A big-ass backpack, two sleeping bags, and a 12-person Coleman tent that was so hard to set up, he got thoroughly drenched his first night. Kane, whose real name is Kevin Horton, settled into the woods surrounding Hellman Hollow. For more than 20 years, no one could figure out how to help him get a real roof over his head. Kane became a fixture of the park, known by locals for carrying a staff he'd carved from fallen trees, accompanied by his yellow lab, Honey. He knew all the park's hidden trails, the best places to pick blackberries, as big as my pinky finger, and the hive in an old cypress where he could collect honey to mix with his vodka. People would tell him, "Damn, Kane, you know more about that park than the park rangers do," he recalls. It was a semi-wild way of life. While most of his food came from the supermarket, he occasionally caught fish in the park's Metzen Lake to grill, or made stew from raccoons or squirrels caught by Honey. He used the park's restrooms when they were open and kept a bucket by his tent for when they weren't. He was sometimes friendly and chatty, sometimes ranty, and he was always deeply protective of the meadow, alerting the gardeners to trees that needed trimming, or warning parents to keep their kids away from the poisonous hemlock on the hillsides. Late one night, he discovered a naked woman sitting on the curb. He gave her a sweatshirt, let her sleep in his tent while he slept outside, and in the morning went to the police at the horse stable so they could call her parents. In turn, many who played in the meadow looked after him, sharing food from picnics and barbecues. For years, park staff tried unsuccessfully to dislodge Kane. Recreation and Parks Department rangers would side him and tell him to move. The department's environmental services crew, who clear abandoned campsites, would tear down his tent when he was out and haul away his possessions. Members of the Homeless Outreach Team, or HOT, the city program that controls access to shelter beds, would occasionally stop by and ask Kane if he wanted a placement. His answer was always an emphatic no. Hellman Hollow was his home. In March 2021, a woman named Amanda Barrows became a park ranger, joining a special detail focused on unhoused people, helping to connect them with housing or other services. Inevitably, that meant dealing with Kane, who by then was nearing 60. Barrows slowly learned that he'd had a rough childhood and had grown up in a foster family. The park was his childhood refuge, a place where he'd spend afternoons wandering around and riding the carousel. She understood then why he had such a deep attachment to the place. For Barrows, trying to forcibly remove Kane from the park seemed both ineffective and cruel. I was like, clearly this is not working. He rebuilds, he comes back. What we're doing is harming this person who's obviously just stuck. So let's try something else. And so she did. I spent 2 years following Barrows and some of those she calls her clients to better understand what it takes to unstick someone who's been stuck on the streets or in a park for a long time. A welter of problems can make someone chronically homeless. Addiction, mental illness, disabilities, trauma, poverty, not to mention failures of the system. None are easily or quickly solved, even after the person is housed. To do more than just shuffle a person from one spot to another demands persistence, patience, coordination of services, and intense personal engagement. Instead of applying force to get Kane out of the park, Barrows offered a helping hand. She embarked on a slow campaign of earning his trust and shepherding him through what one park department official described as the arduous and achingly bureaucratic tasks necessary just to be eligible for housing. Kane had no ID. All his required public documents, from a birth certificate to criminal records, were under a different name, and they all had to be aligned to move his housing application forward. Getting everything in order meant trips to various agencies, and the only way to ensure Kane went was if someone accompanied him, either a member of HOT or Barrows and another ranger, who was her partner at the time. Even then, Kane repeatedly balked. For him, it was overwhelming, Barrows recalled. All the while, she tried to help him see that leaving the park didn't mean losing his connection to it. This can still be your home, but just in a different way, she'd tell him. He could gain the comforts of living indoors and still enjoy the park. It could be like a choice, something you come and go from versus something you're stuck in. After 7 months of cajoling, hand-holding, and advocacy by Barrows, Kane, in October 2021, was granted a room at the Civic Center Hotel Navigation Center shelter, where he could stay until he was assigned permanent housing. Barrows and her partner helped him pack and hauled his two suitcases, heavy with gear, broken electronics, and sticks and rocks he'd collected at the park, up to his fifth-floor room. They helped him settle in by donating furniture and clothes, including the boots and pants worn by rangers. "We knew that's what it was going to take to make it happen," Barrows said. But when they went back the next day to check on him, Kane was gone. Barrows had a hunch about where to find him. She drove to Hellman Hollow, to his last campsite. He was lying under the bushes, barely conscious and near frozen from the previous night's pelting rain. "He'd left the shelter," he later explained, "because some idiot began smart-mouthing me, and I felt like I was going to punch his head off. I didn't. I went back home." Barrows called an ambulance. Kane fought the EMTs when they tried to sedate him for the trip to the hospital. But when she visited him at the Navigation Center a few days later, he was back to his genial self. He told her with a chuckle, "I'm not doing that again," and he hasn't. Things don't always work out so neatly, as Barrow's experience with another park dweller shows. Ronnie Morissette became homeless in 2004 when he was 18, after the grandfather who raised him died and the family home was sold. He'd been in and around the park for more than a decade and liked it. It's the closest thing we San Francisco kids will ever see to nature, he said. He's a compact, muscular man who can be funny and charming and also suspicious and volatile in ways that make him his own worst enemy. Barrows met Morissette in 2021 when he was living in the woods near the archery field. He immediately made clear that he had no interest in pursuing housing. He said he was on a spiritual quest. As he later told me, he liked the freedom of living outside. It tested his abilities and kept his racing mind busy. The same thing he felt when he smoked crystal meth or, as a kid, swallowed ADHD drugs. When Morissette's tent site got too messy or drew complaints, she'd let him know he had to move but gave him time to pack up his things, knowing he'd likely find another site nearby. Still, she couldn't always protect him from sweeps by the Environmental Services crew. When that happened, she would sympathize with his rage and frustration over the loss of his things. Soon enough, though, he'd have a new tent, sleeping bags, blankets, suitcases, pots, pans, bikes, tools, and all manner of other stuff. Still, the cycle was exhausting and taking a toll on his health. The one bright spot in his life was a puppy a friend had given him, a sweet tan hound with golden eyes whom he named Joy. In a common act for Barrows, she bought Joy a leash and collar, along with dog toys and food. By the fall of 2023, Morissette was taking small steps toward moving inside. With Barrows' encouragement, he got himself on the waiting list for transitional housing, a place to live until something more permanent opened up. But in early November, Morissette's mood plunged. He was coming up on the one-year anniversary of the overdose death of a woman he described as the love of my life. One morning when his asthma was bad, he went to the emergency room, taking Joy with him. Because dogs weren't allowed, Animal Care and Control was called to hold her at the pound. Morissette was so distraught he left the hospital, against medical advice, a catheter still in his arm. 2 days later, he overdosed on fentanyl. By then, he was living in an encampment of RVs and tents next to the park. Barrows and one of the RV residents administered Narcan and CPR until an ambulance arrived. The incident shook her deeply. She feared if Morissette didn't change his life soon, he would die, either deliberately or accidentally. The encampment was subject to multiple sweeps over the next several months. During one in March 2024, hot workers offered Morissette a spot at a downtown hotel where he could have his own room and bathroom and bring Joy. Barrows urged him to take it, pointing out it perfectly met his needs. Too tired to resist anymore, he wearily agreed. The room was comfortable, but it felt strange to be inside. "I'm going to die in that room," Morissette told me a few days after moving in. To ease the transition, Barrows visited regularly or met Morissette at parks to take a walk. She was pleased to see how much healthier and stronger he seemed. The longtime cough was gone. He seemed more relaxed, like his nervous system got a break, like he could rest his head and feel safe at night. "It makes a huge difference," she said. He wasn't as on edge. But in September, Morissette got into a fight with staff at the Monarch and was evicted. "It was devastating," Barrows said, "because she was out of town dealing with a family crisis. She couldn't intervene or help him lodge an appeal. It angered her that one bout of bad behavior could cost him so dearly. Given his background and mental health issues, the hotel should have cut him more slack," she thought. "I'm biased," she admitted, "but some zero-tolerance policies result in this revolving door that isn't serving anybody." Morissette was back to living outside, this time in a borrowed RV. It was cramped and decrepit, but warmer and drier than a tent. I asked if he wanted to pursue housing again, and he answered bluntly, "Why would I?" Still, Barrows has hope. She knows that despite all the challenges, it's possible to get even the most intractably unhoused person inside. Kane was proof of that. 10 months after moving to the Civic Center Navigation Center, Kane obtained permanent supportive housing at the Allen Hotel, a single-room occupancy. Barrows continued to stay in touch. In early 2024, she learned he was in danger of losing the general assistance benefits that cover his $165 monthly rent due to a bureaucratic snafu. He'd missed two appointments to clear up the problem, and Barrows was determined not to let him miss another. To make sure of that, she accompanied him to the County Adult Assistance Program's office. It was so difficult to get him into supportive housing. The last thing we want is for him to come out and have to restart everything, she said. You have to commit to that kind of intensive work. Certainly, it has helped Kane stay inside. He remains at the Allen and hopes to move to a bigger place with a kitchen. And though it doesn't happen as much as he'd like, he still visits Golden Gate Park when he's able. On a recent trip to Hellman Hollow, he stepped into the meadow, looked around with a smile, and sighed. Ah, I miss it. And it misses me. This was adapted from a story first published in the San Francisco Standard. Pick up a couple of the health and science articles. A 1.5 million year old tool factory. Archaeologists have uncovered a cache of 27 carved bone tools in northern Tanzania that date back 1.5 million years, a million years before our hominin ancestors were thought to have developed the ability to systematically make such implements. While research has shown that humans started crafting tools from chipstone about 3.3 million years ago, the earliest known bone tools were found at European sites thought to be 250,000 to 500,000 years old. The 27 tools excavated at Tanzania's Olduvai Gorge all came from the limbs of large animals, mostly elephants and hippos, and were shaped and sharpened in a similar fashion. Some were carved into elongated sticks with sharpened points at one end and notches at the other end that could have been used as a grip. Others resemble pear-shaped hand axes that may have been used for butchering meat. Though no hominin remains were discovered at the site, researchers suspect the craftsmen were members of Homo erectus, a direct human ancestor or side branch species called Paranthropus bosai, reports Science News. Neither species was previously known for its smarts or skills with tools. But Ignacio de la Torre, co-director of the evacuation, says the find suggests that these early humans underwent a cognitive breakthrough in the way they viewed animals. They no longer saw the beast around them simply as dangerous competitors or just foodstuff, but also as a source of raw materials for producing tools. Repairing knees with noses. For people with aching knees, a fix could lie between their eyes, reports the Times. Cartilage, the rubbery tissue that cushions knees and other joints, doesn't heal on its own. And so existing treatments for damage caused by injury or wear and tear, such as physical therapy and joint replacement surgery, are of limited effectiveness. A new approach devised by Swiss researchers involves removing a sliver of cartilage from a patient's nasal septum, a procedure that can be done under local anesthetic. The cartilage cells are then grown on soft fiber scaffold, forming tissue that can be grafted into the patient's knee. In a study of 98 patients split into two groups, one of which received grafts matured for 2 days, and the other for 2 weeks, those who got the more mature cartilage saw immediate improvement and continued to get better 2 years after the procedure. This is a promising finding, says study co-author Ivan Martin. Researchers now plan to test the method on osteoarthritis, a chronic condition in which the joint breaks down over time. And we'll finish out on the Talking Points page, as usual. Here we had the article referred to in the cover drawing. Schumer, did he betray the Democrats? Chuck Schumer committed the grave sin of accepting reality, said Brendan Buck in the New York Times, and his party is now furious. The Senate minority leader is facing his Democratic colleagues' ire after he and nine establishment colleagues voted yes last week to pass the House Republicans' six-month stopgap funding bill, which prevented an imminent government shutdown. Many House and Senate Democrats who want to try to block President Trump's agenda at any cost are questioning his leadership. In the House, the progressive champion Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez called Schumer's decision a huge slap in the face and a betrayal, and there is talk she'll mount a future primary challenge to Schumer in New York. The progressive wing is spoiling for a fight to solve its morale problem, said Nick Cattagio in the Dispatch. But as Schumer recognized, a government shutdown would have been a gift to Trump. The spectacle would have diverted the public's attention from the severe damage his tariff war is doing to the economy, and a shutdown would have given Elon Musk and his flying monkeys a pretext to dogify the entire federal bureaucracy, laying off hundreds of thousands of workers who'd never get their jobs back. Schumer had only bad political options, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial, but that's the Democrats' fault. With Republicans controlling both the House and Senate, Democrats have little leverage other than a Senate filibuster. That's the price of voter backlash against 4 years of progressive governance. The party's frustrated left-wing activists are demanding theater, not strategy, said Noah Rothman in National Review. Indeed, polling shows 80% of Democrats want their leaders to be more combative toward Trump. But the current cast of Democrats cannot give their base what it wants. An already demoralized Democratic base is now wondering where to go from here, said Hayes Brown in MSNBC. The party's favorability rating has cratered to just 29%, its lowest in more than 30 years, as voters lose faith that Democratic leadership can present a viable alternative to Trump or stand up to an aspiring autocrat as he tramples the Constitution. In refusing to use every tool in his power to stop Trump, Schumer has left Democrats wondering if their leaders' warnings about the threat Trump poses to the country will be reflected in their actions. The EPA, let's not forget about climate change. I'm sorry, it says let's forget about climate change. President Trump's Environmental Protection Agency is ready to make polluters great again, said Hayes Brown in MSNBC.com. EPA Director Lee Zeldin last week said he'll cancel 31 environmental regulations, declaring it the largest deregulatory announcement in U.S. history, while Trump vowed to promote the opening of hundreds of coal-fired power plants. Coal produces far more pollutants than other energy sources, and was being rapidly phased out. But in a social media post, Trump called coal beautiful and clean. Instead of curbing pollution and combating climate change, Zeldin said, the agency's mission is to lower the cost of buying a car, heating a home, and running a business. Policies being scaled back or repealed include rules on greenhouse gas emissions. More than 1,100 staff scientists are being fired. Environmental justice offices, which enforce laws helping poor and minority communities, are being shuttered. And the agency will no longer consider the cost of climate disasters in its policies. These deeply misguided actions will grant businesses a new license to pollute and speed up the clock on the planet becoming unlivable. Zeldin is actually righting an environmental wrong, said Noah Rothman in National Review. The most important of his policy changes is the reversal of the Obama administration's 2009 endangerment finding, which enabled the federal government to cite the Clean Air Act as legal justification for regulating greenhouse gas emissions like carbon dioxide from energy plants, cars and trucks, household appliances, and gas exploration. That policy, which Zeldin called the holy grail of the climate change religion, gave the EPA enormous regulatory authority over the economy and imposed enormous cost on businesses. Zeldin is amply justified in chipping away at its legacy. "You'll miss the EPA when it's gutted," said former EPA heads William K. Riley, Christine Todd Whitman, and Gina McCarthy. Under both Republican and Democratic administrations, the agency helped clean the nation's waterways and air, replace lead pipes and asbestos, reduce acid rain and remove toxins and nuclear waste from the nation's most contaminated lands. It also fought to protect poor people whose neighborhoods took the brunt of pollution from power plants, garbage incinerators, refineries, and factories. Now the EPA is being dismantled, and more Americans will be left sicker and will die sooner. And that leaves us just enough time for a couple of quotes. Journalist A.J. Leibling says, "Freedom of the press is guaranteed only to those who own one." And Edmund Burke says, "Nobody made a greater mistake than he who did nothing because he could do only a little." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information, or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And as always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.